Well, hello, faithful listener, and welcome to the Small Voice podcast for August. My name is Darren, and joining me across the interweb are the regular team of Anne.
Hello.
And Holly.
Hello.
Fresh and ready to bring you another hour of music and musings on matters moral, ethical, and spiritual. So, no matter where you are in the world and whatever your COVID-19 situation, be that post-lockdown, pre-second spike lockdown, unlocked lockdown phase 3.5, or just general post-apocalyptic hysteria, welcome, welcome, and thrice welcome. You're amongst friends here. This month, in our media review, we're reviewing the new novel Scabby Queen by Kirsten Innes, while Margaret speaks to Andrew Greystone for another Small Voice of the Month. On the music front, we're delighted to be able to bring you a couple of special tracks from folk and Americana duo Too Far Flung, and also Arcadian folk musician Aidan Moody. And we will, of course, round things off with our moral mixdown. But ahead of all that, it's time to check in with the team to see how life has been of late in our Heaven and Hell health check. Anne.
There was definitely one moment of heaven, and that was on Saturday. The only places I'd been in the last few months were my doctor's surgery and then very recently my dentist's surgery. And so it was lovely to go somewhere that was really quite beautiful. Somewhere I'd never been before, even though it's only about 30 minutes north of Glasgow. A wee place called Lennoxtown, which is not a kind of rural idyll. It's a wee post-industrial town. But they had the most beautiful wildlife pond there that they've created for the community. It's called Whitefield Pond, and it's to encourage biodiversity. And it was just throbbing with life, with ducks and swans and water lilies, and they've planted wildflower meadows, and the butterflies were everywhere. And it was just one of those absolutely beautiful experiences in a most unexpected wee place.
Okay, sounds good. Holly.
So this month has been characterised for me by working. I have been working an awful lot. And because of what my job is, so I'm a palliative care doctor, I did a lot of talking about death and dying. I did a lot of supporting people through some very difficult times in their lives. There was an awful lot of blood, there was an awful lot of tears, and because of how hot it is at the moment, there was an awful lot of very sweaty PPE. And it wasn't heavenly, and it certainly wasn't hellish, but it was boring, but also transcendent. It was really sad, it was also really joyous. And the only thing I can only think of two ways to describe it, and one is the new normal, and the second is earthy. So I'm going to go with earthy,
okay,
which is a bit of a cop-out.
Not at all. Instead of heaven and hell, you can have earthy. Yeah, why not? In one way, a very small thing for us, but a huge thing for other people. We went to a wedding on Saturday. Well, we didn't, you know. I guess about 15 people went to a wedding. Still not even totally sure where the wedding was. But we had been invited to a wedding in April, which obviously then got cancelled. It's a young couple in their 20s, and it's rescheduled for next year. But, you know, they wanted to get married, and they were getting married in church, so they made the decision. I think having maybe at some point decided, let's postpone the wedding, they've then thought, no, we'll have the celebration, but we really want to have the wedding. And it was just lovely, such a normal thing. Except it was in no way, shape or form normal, you know, to be watching on a Zoom meeting, very much like this. But it was just a lovely thing. And what was really sweet was, I think, the minister actually gave a personal thank you to them, because I'm guessing that must be a part of his job, of any minister's job, that you really miss. You know, particularly if what you're tending to see is the other stuff. The funerals have not stopped. Yes, it's harder to go to them, but weddings have kind of dried up. So that was just a lovely little kind of normal, small scale kind of beautiful thing, you know, as we emerge blinking into the daylight, or alternatively look up and shout, oh no, the sky is falling, and run back again. I don't know. Yeah, I think you've summed it up absolutely, Holly. Earthy. Now, a big thanks to everyone who got in touch with us about the podcast after last month. Firstly, a slightly belated hello to Michael in Pennsylvania. Michael said in an email that he's been enjoying our COVID podcasts. So thanks, Michael. Yeah, there's probably a box set because there definitely has been a bit of a theme recently.
There most certainly has. Roz also got in touch via our website following our discussion last month about how best to emerge from lockdown. She said thanks and simply that she'd found the discussion helpful, honest and reassuring. So thank you, Roz. We do our best.
And thanks as ever to regular listener Katrina, who left a comment on our website. Katrina says that she's been trying to formulate her own words on some of her lockdown experiences and emotions for some time. She says, "I'm afraid lockdown hasn't given me space to think. It's been totally full on. But as I listened to your reflections, seeing what resonated and what didn't, it encouraged me to go for it." So Katrina's written a blog post, which you can find if you search for Skinny Fairtrade Latte blog, or if you go to our website and you can find those details in the comments section, and that post is well worth a read.
Absolutely. Finally, a quick shout out to Geraldine, who has just been catching up with our June podcast and its discussion of Black Lives Matter, which she says is interesting to listen to from where we are now, a couple of months later. Anyway, she goes on to say that she always enjoys the podcast and finds listening best while cooking or sewing. So very industrious of you, Geraldine. We do love to hear your comments and feedback on the items we discuss. So please, everyone, say hello via our website, smallvoice.org.uk, or on Twitter at small_voice1, or pop by our Facebook page.
For our media review this month, we have been reading Scabby Queen by Kirsten Innes. Unusually, the book starts with the suicide of the main character, Scottish musician and activist Cleona Campbell, known as Cleo. The book then proceeds to tell the story of Cleo from the perspectives of lots of people that she knew at different stages of her life, weaving these stories together to form a sort of portrait of Cleo. Here's an extract read by Darren.
Cleo had her rituals while she was at the cottage, and Ruth would tick them off as the signs of recovery. After a few days, while Ruth was at work, she would lift the creaky oilskin that had belonged to Ruth's gran down from its peg, pull on Ruth's wellies, which were two sizes too big for her, and venture out into the woods behind the garden. Not far at first. Ruth would come in and rub her hand over the oilskin as she hung up her own coat, every day, to check whether its stiffness had been disturbed, whether there was any wetness still on it. She never asked Cleo about this. Old Frank, who lived next door and had courted Ruth's gran for years, would let her know. "She just stands there," he said. "She's right still, keeping the house in her eye line, not quite on the path. Sometimes for about an hour, no one but us would be able to see her." The singing would come back next. Just a faint humming under her breath at first, notes pitched into nowhere as she moved, or a slight drone floating over from the couch where she was reading. If all was going well, in a couple of days this would turn into murmured words, then two or three lines, then the sound. Cleo's lungs waking up as they remembered what they could do. The singing stage was a delicate one, though. She was more vulnerable then than when she slumped in chairs without washing for days, fretting her knuckles together. At this point, Ruth would become solicitous, always made sure the cupboards were well stocked when she left for work. Once early on, she'd come home to find that Cleo had cut her finger and dripped slashes of blood all over the kitchen trying to make soup. Discarded onion skins littered the counter, the saucepan had burned dry, and Cleo was back in bed, her hand wrapped in the sheets, soaking through. This time, though, the house had filled with song as Cleo came downstairs each morning, Gaelic lullabies and old pop songs echoing through the hall as she sat on the toilet. This time, it had all seemed to be fixing itself.
So that's an extract from early in this pretty complicated book. And Dare I ask what you thought?
Well, I mean, I will not lie to you. This was a book I had to wrestle into submission. It's a big book. It's a very rangy book. And as you mentioned, Holly, in your introduction, the story of Cleo is told never in her own words, apart from one kind of remarkable section near the end of the book. It's her story is told through the perspectives of a whole host of other people. And for a while, I found it quite hard to keep tabs on who each of these other people actually were. Even though there's a helpful little section at the start of the novel which lists the kind of key characters. So it took me a wee while to get into it. But I have to say that there were things that I did love about it. I did like the fact that because we never really hear Cleo's story in our own words, but only from these numerous other perspectives, we're never really sure whether we like her or not, because we're allowed to see her both in the eyes of people who adore her and through the eyes of people that she drives absolutely round the bend. And so these perspectives keep shifting, but of course that's really what human beings are. Sometimes we are adorable and sometimes we drive people round the bend, and it's such a humane way to look at someone. In this kind of era when we seem to need to either create heroes that we then tear down or look right away for the clay feet and therefore write people off before they get started, there's something deeply appealing about being able to just say, this is who this woman was. She was both maddening and wonderful. I also think there are two magnificent set pieces in the novel that are just tour de force of writing. One is a piece in which Cleo and one of her mates in the squat that they're sharing in London when they're trying to change the world together, get together and talk about whether or not women should wear makeup or not. And Cleo's speech about that, how she defends the right of working class women to put on their makeup and to sort their clothes and go out and sparkle, I just thought was a tour de force of writing. And the other piece is her rant on the morning after the independence referendum vote, when Cleo gets incredibly drunk after it becomes clear that the vote is going to be no. And both of these are just wonderful set pieces and worth reading the entire novel for these alone. Beyond that though, Holly, there were maybe two things that I thought really did chime with me. One was the idea of trying to make the world a better place, but not always agreeing on how to do it, and having to somehow get along with people and be tolerant of other people's approaches to doing it. Even when we share the same aim, sometimes we can disagree about how to get there. And the other was a debate that goes on in my head all the time. And in the novel, it's put into the mouths of Cleo and her friend Xanthi, who, after being a sort of political activist like Cleo, kind of sets it aside and goes and teaches yoga on a Greek island and finds peace, some kind of inner peace. And at one point she says to Cleo, I did my battling, I put in my time, it's exhausting being angry every day. And that argument goes on in my head just about every day, that yearning to sort of set aside the struggle, as it were, for whatever it is we mean by justice in the world, and the desire just for some peace.
Yeah, I mean, I really struggled to get into this book, and I have to say up front, I really loved it. I really loved it, but it was hard won. I sat down at the beginning and was like, who's talking again? Who's this person? I don't understand. Why are there so many people? And there's a huge number of narrative voices. And it makes it really difficult to get into at first because it jumps around. So the structure of the book, it's not linear. So you hear about the same time period from lots of different people, but that might be separated by, oh, we're in the 80s and now we're in 2018 and now we're doing this and now we're doing that. And that is something that I really struggled with the structure when I started. And I did something then that sometimes I do whenever I struggle with the structure of a book, which is I gave up completely and I bought the audiobook. And I listen to audiobooks an awful lot. And this is an investment of an audiobook. It's nearly 15 hours of an audiobook. Oof. Oh, yeah. And I got about 20 minutes into it and I absolutely fell in love with it. It is one of the best narrated audiobooks that I have ever heard, because Kathleen McCarran, who narrates the audiobook, gives everyone in the book an accent and a voice, and she does, and they're not caricatures and they work. They are all deeply humane characterizations of people, and suddenly in a very dialogue heavy scene I was suddenly able to work out what was going on and it absolutely changed the book for me. So I wonder, I think I share that it took a while to hit its stride for me, but once it did, it started to lift off the page. I found myself crying. There's a vignette towards the end and I found myself just, I'll not spoil it, but I just found myself weeping in the car. And if you told me that when I picked up the book and started trying to read it and couldn't work out what was going on, I wouldn't have believed you. So I don't know whether there's something about, once I started listening to the audiobook, I was able to pick up the book again. So I'm not saying it doesn't work as a book, because it absolutely does, but I have a real, really keen on the audiobook. Darren, I'm really interested to know what you thought of this one, because it is a...
I won't say anything like men don't come out of it well, but there's not that many terribly sympathetic male characters. You know, I quite like books like this where you pick it up and you say, okay, right, so we're doing the timey-wimey thing and we're doing the different voices thing. And you've got to have writing chops for that, because you need to have the characters sympathetic enough that you want to continue with them. And I think she definitely manages that, Kirsten Innes. And they need to feel alive. You know, you need to be able to inhabit the different characters. And, you know, I think Kirsten Innes... she's certainly not a jaded 50-year-old music journalist, you know, male kind of has been, but she manages to get that very well. But I would say, you know, so I picked this up and I thought, oh, this is great. Yeah, it's very readable. I'm enjoying it. But I didn't get hugely drawn into it. And this does seem to be a little bit of a theme in that I'm not quite sure. Was there a big mystery at the heart of this? I'll come back to that. But what I would say is that if you're going to do that sometimes, and maybe I'm kind to mention another book, take The Crow Road by Ian Banks, which has parallel time streams. And there's a definite kind of big secret at the heart of that fits together, it locks together so well. I've got an issue maybe with the editor of this book, in that there's a couple of times where I think, mate, you needed to tell me that we just moved back 10 years. And they sometimes do that really, really clearly. But in one time, from one page to the next, I was just completely lost. But my point is this. There's a couple of mysteries maybe at the heart of this book. It's not whodunit or anything like that, or why done it maybe. There's, without giving too much away, there's something that she did early on which brought disgrace to her family. And you find that out towards the very end of the book. And I was left a bit baffled by that, if I'm honest. It didn't slot together well for me.
So I think I have the explanation for that. I've read an interview with Kirsten Innes where she talks about bending the plot to fit the title that she wanted to give the book.
Okay.
And when I read that, I thought, well, that makes sense, because I knew in my mind what Cleo had done. And then it got to the very end of the book and it wasn't what she'd done. And I do wonder whether the rest of the book was written with one ending.
Okay.
And
you know,
it didn't
what?
Quite
and,
fit.
And without giving anything away, thank you for that. Maybe I'm just a bit stupid. I would say again, though, I'd really rather you didn't end the book. I mean, look, she commits suicide. I mean, it's bleak in that sense. But the last few pages I was struggling with, because it is such a bleak, tough character, not her, that you're left with. And maybe that's just me. The other one, though, and I think Anne and I maybe disagree on this, is there's something that you find out about two-thirds of the way through in relation to the suicide. And I have to confess, I went, nah, I'm not buying that. I'm just not buying that.
Without spoiling it, I'm going to have to agree with Darren. Didn't do it for me at all. Because I was so swept up in what the rest of the book was. And for me, the rest of the book was an acknowledgement that people are really complex and that you don't know what's going on inside your friends' heads. You don't know what's going on inside the heads of the people that you love. The people that you hate will be somebody that somebody else adores, and people are mysterious and are made up of all of the relationships that they have with others. And then there was a couple of set pieces that just didn't quite chime for me, but I think it was worth it in many ways. I wonder whether the audiobook worked so well for me because I almost took it like it was an oral history of Cleo Campbell, that it almost would have worked as a series of interviews about her. And audio is my favourite medium, so I think
it would work well on radio.
I think it would have worked well on the radio, not for 15 hours maybe, but
it would have worked well on the radio. Did you buy it, you know, when Holly and I are agreeing, and I know we're not giving away spoilers here.
Well,
I think you maybe found that quite powerful.
I indicated that it's the only point in the novel in which we purportedly hear Cleo's own voice, her own justification of her actions. And no, I didn't buy it because I thought it was a narrative like everything else. None of the narratives from any of the other characters of any of these other folk who knew her through the years were complete or completely convincing, and nor was her own for me. But isn't this what we all do? We all create a narrative that we believe about ourselves, that we quite profoundly believe about ourselves, but it's always self-edited in some way. I thought there were, again, I'm terribly worried about spoilers, but I thought that the ending of the book properly undercut her own explanation of her motives and made me think of many other reasons why she might have committed suicide, which of course is the very first thing that happens in the novel. It's not a secret, that's not a spoiler. So again, it seemed to me to reinforce the idea that the truth is complex and is so many faceted, and we ourselves are not the holders of the truth about ourselves. You would have to put together all of those stories, as Kirsten Innes does, to try and bring alive a complete picture of who this woman was, with all her convictions and her deep, deep flaws, with all her support of vulnerable people and her using of people for her own ends. Again, I guess what each of us is both capable of and guilty of in the way that we live our lives.
I do wonder whether it's a book that is different for everybody, because each of us will empathise with a different narrator. And I'd love to, after the podcast, because it'll mean nothing to anyone listening, I would love to know who of Cleo's friends you are, because I think that probably says a lot about what you think of Cleo. And leaving that all up in the air, that great mystery.
And I think that's for the comment section on the website, Holly. Please let us know which of Cleo's friends you think you are.
Absolutely. And I think none of our enjoyment of this book was uncomplicated. But I'm going to say I would thoroughly recommend our listeners read it.
Yeah.
And talk about it afterwards.
And talk about it.
You will want to.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm looking for everyone I know to read it.
Yeah.
Scabby Queen by Kirsten Innes is published by Fourth Estate and is available from all bookshops, good and bad. Of course, the Small Voice team encourage you to buy from your friendly local independent if you can. And as I said, I would thoroughly recommend checking out the audiobook narrated by Kathleen McCarran, which is a real treat.
Now for some music. This month we are featuring music from Too Far Flung, who are the very lovely Alan and Grace Murray. They recorded this specially for us during lockdown, for which many thanks. It's a song written a couple of years ago by Alan, and it's called Easier Alone.
know you want to hear I'm coming home, so far from me. Lately it's been easier alone. Lately it's been easier
was Too Far Flung with Easier Alone. Check out their Facebook page to keep up with their news, and remember, it's a difficult time for musicians just now, so do please remember to buy, like and share if you can. Now for our Small Voice of the Month, where we feature a person or organisation who may be small but is making a big difference. This month, Margaret has been speaking to writer and broadcaster Andrew Greystone. When we heard about Andrew's new book called Faith, Hope and Mischief, which is about what he describes as tiny acts of rebellion, doing small things that make a big difference, well, our ears most definitely pricked up. Here's Margaret with more.
Our small voice of the month this time round was inspired by a book. I'd like to say the book was inspired by the Small Voice podcast, but no. However, it shares the message that small actions can have a big impact. The book has just been published. It's called Faith, Hope and Mischief, and it's written by Andrew Greystone. Andrew is a broadcaster and writer, and as you can imagine, there's lots to find on social media about him. But I was struck by something else. Obviously, people usually smile for photographs, especially when it's a publicity type shot. However, there was something engagingly cheerful about Andrew's smile in every photo I saw. And I had to ask him if it indicated that he has a positive outlook on life.
I hope I do, yes. I think that hope is really important to me. I'm a future-focused person. Hope can be misinterpreted, I think. Hope isn't always about just kind of thinking the best, because the opposite of hope is not pessimism. Pessimism is sometimes quite realistic when you're looking at what potential outcomes there might be for a situation. But the opposite of hope is cynicism, is giving up. And I'm not a one for that. I'm a one for looking at the future and saying, well, we are where we are. What could we do to make the future work better? Now, the thing is, once you've asked yourself that, I look at the world and I think, oh, there's a lot of grot in the world, a lot of trouble in the world. I would like to make things better, but I'm not Malala Yousafzai. I'm not Greta Thunberg. I haven't got the wealth of Bill Gates or the brain of Stephen Hawking. What can I do? And my conclusion is that actually the world changes through tiny acts of rebellion, tiny acts of kindness, of doing something when it would have been just as easy to do nothing. And that's what the the book that I've written is all about. It's just stories of moments when I guess I could have done nothing and did something. And sometimes that worked out well, sometimes it didn't work out so well. But I want to encourage people to be what I call everyday activists, doing the something, taking an action that may well make a difference. So it's just full of examples of that.
That obviously leads me into the question. Give me an example of something that really worked very well.
Well, the example that's the first story in the book and the picture that's on the cover is of something that happened in 2019. I woke up one morning, like lots of people, to hear the awful news of the massacre in two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, when a gunman had gone in and opened fire and killed 49 people in those mosques. And I woke up that Friday morning and thought, that is so awful, but it's the other side of the world. There's nothing I can do. And then I thought, I wonder how people in my local mosque here in Manchester would be feeling this morning as they go to Friday prayers. Would they be feeling frightened or angry or confused or isolated? And I thought, maybe I could go and stand just outside the mosque and smile and greet people, or just, I don't know, just be with them. So 11 o'clock in the morning, as people were just heading off, Muslims were heading off towards Friday prayers, I decided to do that. I just walked down to the local mosque. I'd thought to myself, if I just stand there grinning, I'm going to look a bit weird. So I made a little sign that said, you are my friends, I will keep watch while you pray. And I stood outside the mosque as people came in for prayers. A lot of people walked past, scurried past in a hurry, late for prayers. Some of them gave me slightly strange looks as if they wondered what I was doing there. Anyway, when they came out after about 90 minutes, everybody was wanting to shake my hand and salaam me and talk to me. And I found out that the imam of the mosque had mentioned me in his sermon and had explained that he felt this was an act of, I don't know, solidarity or kindness. And so the atmosphere changed completely. Now, in the middle of all of that, somebody said, can I take a photograph, like people do these days? So he took a photograph, and then it was all done, and I toddled off back home. And then during that afternoon, I began to see this photograph popping up on social media, on Twitter and Facebook. He put it onto our community Facebook page with a note saying, who is this guy? And by the end of the afternoon, this photograph of me standing outside a mosque with a flat hat and a sign saying, you are my friends, had started to go all around the world. And I started to get messages about it from literally every country you can think of, all over the world. People saying, thank you for doing this. Thank you for standing up. Thank you for your courage. Well, I didn't think I was that brave. I'd just gone and walked up the road. But it seemed to have struck a chord with people. And over the next couple of weeks, I was absolutely inundated with people wanting to know more, wanting to ask about it or do television or radio interviews. And the most moving thing actually was to be able to speak to people of Christchurch, New Zealand, where these terrible massacres had happened. And I was able to join them on their breakfast TV station and their local radio station. I could say that we in Manchester know a bit about terrorism. We've been on the receiving end of attacks ourselves, but that things can get better. And the core of what I wanted to say, I think, is that friendship overcomes fear. Friendship is better than hate. And if we can hang on to friendship, that can make a difference. And that just seemed to be a message that resonated. But I was left, you know, in terms of small voices, I was left thinking, well, I could have stayed at home just so easily, just gone and made a cup of coffee and stayed at home and not thought any more about it. But doing something rather than nothing made the difference.
Has it changed your life doing that? And I mean, was it something that you had thought about before, that one person's individual act could make a big difference?
What it did was make me look back at all the other little things that have happened in my life where small acts have made a big difference. And I decided to write them down as stories, and that's what I've done. Now, not all of them go well. Not all of them end well. And I hope they're quite entertaining, and I hope people can have a good laugh at my expense, but also perhaps gain a little bit of inspiration from that. I called the book Faith, Hope and Mischief because on reflecting on the things that had happened to me, I thought those are the three big themes in my life.
I suppose mischief is not something people necessarily associate with Christians. That seems a bit dodgy, really. A mischievous Christian, surely not.
Oh, Margaret, I'm a big fan of mischief. Mischief means jumping over the fence. It means going to a place that you shouldn't or wouldn't normally get to. Standing outside a mosque when you're a Christian, going and meeting people who you wouldn't normally meet, taking a bit of a risk, doing the thing that's cheeky. And I've become convinced of the power of mischief to change the world, actually. Politics can change the world, but I haven't got access to that. Money can change the world, but I haven't got access to that. Mischief can change the world too, just doing the unexpected things, the things that take you into new territory, I think has potential to change the world. I'm a big fan of mischief.
Mischief can change the world? Discuss. Well, I was talking to Andrew Greystone, and if you want to hear more of his mischief, his latest book, Faith, Hope and Mischief, published by Canterbury Press, will give you plenty of examples. And we're always looking for stories of small acts or ideas that have a big impact to feature here as the Small Voice of the Month. Maybe you've done something yourself and been surprised by the result, or you'd like to tell us the story of a group you know of that's doing good stuff. So get in touch via our website, smallvoice.org.uk, Facebook or Twitter feed at small_voice1.
Thanks for that, Margaret and Andrew. We like a bit of mischief here at Small Voice, and as Margaret says, we're always happy to hear your suggestions for Small Voices of the Month, so do please get in touch. And now for some more music. We're delighted to feature a new song from Aidan Moody. Back in the days when musicians could play in front of real live audiences, Aidan played with Iona Fife for a fabulous Small Voice session at the Wild Olive Tree Cafe in August last year. That's a year ago, folks. Jings. Anyway, we got back in touch with Aidan and we're delighted he recorded this new song for us for a video on our Facebook page. It's a lovely, lovely song written during lockdown and is called Far.
A magpie and his 20 quill, oh, sharp as handfuls of glass, and cloth sails they sing as the ship sails from shore. Still we find warmth far from home, far from home, far from home we grow. Dancing on a tightrope walk, steps soft as hills to a sunrise, and two turns they twirl round towers that aren't theirs. Still we find warmth far from home, far from home, far from home we grow, far from home. From home, far from home we grow, far from home we grow. What we know moves to what we knew, people grow and they fired us too. What we know moves to what we knew, it's what we knew. What we know moves to what we knew, people grow, fired us to what we know moves to what we knew. It's what we knew. Far from home, far from home we drove. Far from home we drove. Far from home, far from home we drove. Far from home.
That was Aidan Moody with Far. You can go to Aidan's Facebook page for more music and news. Search for Aidan Moody or go to our website and we'll have all his details there too. And so to our Moral Mixdown. I think I did a quiz with the recent Moral Mixdown. I don't want to make it a habit, but here's a quick and easy question for you. What is it that the National Secular Society and the Catholic Church in Scotland have got in common? anyone care to have a pun?
They're both jolly annoyed with the Scottish Government, I think, Darren.
Exactly right. So this is to do with the public consultations just closed on changes to Scotland's hate crime laws. So we have an argument here, if you like, between the right of freedom of expression, which we would expect is what the National Secular Society is concerned with, and maybe freedom of expression from the Catholic Church as well, versus a concern at the rise of incidences of hate crimes against people based on, the plans are to make it a criminal offence to stir up hatred against anyone based on their age, disability, religion, sexual orientation or transgender identity. The Catholic Church, I believe, has said at some point that there's concern, well, you might have to arrest people for having the Bible because the Bible is inflammatory. And the National Secular Society are saying, well, does this mean that, you know, we might have to close down public libraries because there's books in there that would cause offence. But let's come back maybe to the Bible being inflammatory. Or inflammatory books, as opposed to inflammable, by the way. So, Anne, what would be the most likely to give offence on your bookshelf, do you think?
Well, it's funny. I think these things probably relate to particular moments in time, but I do have on my bookshelf a little red book, appropriately called The Rules of the Romanian Communist Party, translated into English for those of us whose Romanian is pretty rubbish. Mine was all right for a year or two, but it's more or less disappeared since I was at university. I spent a term in Romania as an exchange student when Ceausescu was pretending to be a communist. He really was an autocrat. And I got quite interested in Romania as a country and bought several publications by the Romanian Communist Party. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, if I'd wanted to enter the United States of America at the time, would have got me banned.
Absolutely. Yeah. Holly, what about you?
I suppose it depends who you are. I'm such a complex and multifaceted person that I could offend many different people with my bookshelves. So I brought a section and then I've got a couple of others. So my section is a Roman Missal, the Scottish Metrical Psalms, God's Promises, which is God's Promises, which is lots of for your every need, which is lots of Bible verses taken out of context, little evangelical tome, and Glad Day, Daily Meditations for Gay, Bisexual, Lesbian and Transgender People. So I brought these because these all live together on my shelf and probably don't live together on anyone else's shelf.
It's like that so that's, song, that's Ebony and Ivory.
Something to offend everyone.
Yeah.
The other books that I've brought, I suppose it's just to give a bit of a flavour of some words that sometimes people have a bit of a problem with but are reclaimed slurs. And the first is this, which is the collected Dykes to Watch Out For comics by Alison Bechdel, who you may have heard of as the originator of the Bechdel test for films, which is actually one of the characters in Dykes to Watch Out For who says that. So these are a selection of slightly dated now gay comics. And the second is this, which is a more recent publication, which is called The Book of Queer Prophets, curated by Ruth Hunt, which is modern day epistles, she describes it, of 24 LGBTQ authors and activists talking about their faith. It's not all the Christian faith. There's a really interesting drag queen who's Muslim who talks about dervishes and Islam and the history of men dressing up. So absolutely fantastic wee book. But again, some people would have a problem with the Q word on the cover. So those are mine, a selection to offend all. What about you, Darren?
Well, we've got a kind of churchy section over here, so I thought, oh, I'm bound to have something in there that's hugely embarrassing, from my kind of turgid evangelical past. But actually, I'm not saying that a book burning, they probably were donated to some church sale. So actually, I'm going to go for something. Can I admit that it's actually my wife's? But I think this is quite an interesting one. She's got a book on the bookshelf that I can see just now, and it might even be signed, and might not at this, by Chomsky, by Noam Chomsky. Now, it's actually about linguistics and the mind, because that was his field. But the interesting thing about Chomsky, of course, is that, to many, he will be held up as a great left-wing, advocate and, really quite an incredible guy. But to some people, you get that automatic reaction, see on Twitter or something. Chomsky's the guy who defended the guy who said that there were no concentration camps, the Holocaust denier. Actually, he didn't do that, but he did say, this man has a right to say this. And I think he possibly even said it in the introduction to a book, which is not necessarily the wisest political thing to do. So I thought that's maybe an interesting one, and I don't think it would get burned or anything, but it maybe illustrates that issue of the freedom of speech versus, people are going to find that quite offensive. And actually, one of the op-eds I was reading does say that, the problem is you have these competing kind of sides. You know that I'm sure my age here, but there's a Yes Prime Minister sketch where Sir Humphrey asks Jim Hacker questions and manages to get him to say that he's in favour of having nuclear weapons, and then he asks him a different set of questions, and at the end of it he immediately says that he's not in favour of it, just because of how you frame it. So I don't know, having dispatched our inflammatory material, what do we actually think about this?
It's so tricky. I guess in the course of my thinking more deeply about this over the last couple of weeks, I have moved from a position of nuance and being able to balance both sides to a place of absolute flailing and not really knowing what I think anymore, which is like I've tipped off the far end of nuance into something much more complex. So can I hold my hands up and say I don't know. One thing I do know, though, is if you think that your Bible stirs up hatred against people who are black, gay, trans, then it says more about you than it says about your Bible. That's one thing that I have to say about some of the Christians that are against this bill. But I would love to hear your thoughts, because I am flailing and I need help from those who are wiser than I am.
Oh, I wish I could. Hour of need.
In the hour of need. I didn't want to say older.
I'm going to disappoint you, Holly, if you're looking to me, because it's one of those situations where you find yourself on both sides. And there is no right, and to me it seems there is no right and there is no wrong answer. You're just having to choose somehow between two rights in this case rather than two wrongs. So it's finding that tipping point where your right to speak impinges on the right of someone else to feel safe, I guess, is what I hope this bill will eventually find. I think I mentioned at the time a few months ago, and I did some training on how to help women to understand more about the climate crisis. Women, particularly from faith groups, of all faiths, who might not have given a lot of thought to it before. And my tutor was a really astonishingly able Muslim young woman. And at one point she shared with me her own internal dilemma about the fact that she really would love to go everywhere by public transport, but she's too physically afraid, because she wears the hijab, to go everywhere by public transport. So her husband insists that they maintain a car, even though it goes against all of her principles in terms of emissions, because he's too frightened on her behalf, and she herself is really too scared to use public transport on every occasion. So you suddenly realise that that visibility of being Muslim or black or Orthodox Jewish or whatever, the thing that is obvious and clear and you cannot change because it's so visible, can make you so vulnerable that somebody has to say, this is what we're putting in place to protect you, to stop anyone saying or doing anything that can incite someone to go out and hurt you.
But I guess, you know, if someone was attacked, and this is maybe where I think, okay, Holly's, you'll have done your research, Holly, you know, well, there are protections in law at the moment, or are there not?
Yeah.
I mean, all I would know is if you're on a bus and you're being abused and threatened and all that, you know, the police and anyone being arrested for anything must seem a long, long, long way away. Holly?
I guess for me, it's about strengthening some. I think the intention is to strengthen aspects of existing law. And one of the things that it would strengthen is there's a difference between it inciting, you know, saying that you don't like somebody and inciting people to cause that person harm, and saying that you don't like a characteristic of that person that applies to a larger group and inciting harm to that. Or there's something about the hatred that comes with bigotry that makes the crime worse than if it didn't also come with the bigotry. I think that's partly what makes it complicated, because I strongly believe that. I also, if I go out, I'm very privileged. I'm white, I'm cis, I'm able-bodied, I am also feminine presenting and don't get called dyke in the street unless I'm holding hands with my wife, which meant that my wife's disabled, so there was a long period where we were not able to hold hands in the street, and it was a nice change, because when we were in our early 20s, I could not leave my house without being called a dyke, a slut, a trollop once, which was quite interesting. Sometimes like rallying cries from little boys on bicycles, like dyke, as if they were trying to warn people for miles around that I was coming. And I think what is interesting and true and right is that there is, as I read it, nothing in this bill that would stop people doing that to me, because none of those people were inciting hatred of me. They were not stirring up anyone else to do anything. They were just expressing the hatred that they already had. And I'm sort of okay with that, actually. I'm not going to, you know, defend to the death someone who's desperately wants to call me a dyke. But it's also, you know, it's not something I don't call myself sometimes. It's another example of a reclaimed slur. But then I have rarely had reason to fear for my physical safety. So I think, therefore, it's really important that I listen to my black friends and my visibly Muslim friends, my trans friends, my people who can't hide who they are quite so easily as I can in the world. And that's where it starts to rub up against me, because if you presented me the free speech argument, I would agree with you on that one too. But I think at the heart of it, sometimes when I listen to people's free speech argument, it makes me a bit suspicious of the person that's making it. Like, what do you want the freedom to be able to say about who? But equally, I get it, because this bill gets passed now, and what's to stop a fascist government in the future in that it deciding that something else is inflammatory and clamping down on people like me? Like, I get that argument. I just that's an intellectual argument for me, and there's something, I feel it in my gut. The other arguments.
I'm almost about to mention the dreaded Trump word. I mean, we're there anyway, though, aren't we, really? I mean, I think now in terms of, if you have a majority government, I'm not going to say it's a dictatorship, but, you know, any old nonsense can get through, really. I like the idea of public consultations, particularly, you know, if they're finding things difficult. And I'm no expert, because, you know, one thing I'm not is a fan of football. That's because I grew up a Hibs supporter. That's a little joke for anyone who knows about football. But they did try and do something about, you know, chanting at football matches and stuff. And as I recall, it didn't go terribly well. Would that be right? So, you know, if you have a government that's committed to saying, well, we will do this, but if it's not working or if we're tweaking, I am not going to go public working in education on big things that have happened this week in Scotland in education. But it is interesting to see a government saying, you know what, we got something wrong. So maybe if it turns out to be the worst idea, we are adult enough to say, or to adjust and to tweak and adjust and tweak, rather than it's the end of the world either way. I don't know.
Yeah. And you said that a little, you touched on that, didn't you, that it's not quite there yet, but it's maybe getting somewhere good.
Yeah.
Is that a fair representation?
It is. I mean, I guess that by going out to consultation, you hope that, you know, both the humanists and the Catholic bishops will have something equally valuable to say about it. And therefore you take on board the very genuine concerns that they both have from their very different perspectives. About the way in which, at the moment, the law is not quite framed carefully enough, in their view, to allow for the kind of freedom, either religious or to criticise religion, in the way that humanists might want to, or secularists might want to.
Because the other thing this bill does is get rid of blasphemy laws. Is that right?
Yes, I believe so. To which I think we all say yay.
Yeah, I'm up for that. I blaspheme quite a lot. I like that protection.
But yes, I think I'm hopeful, Holly, that that enough people have contributed during the consultation period to make this a genuinely useful bill. I hope so anyway, because I think it really is necessary.
Yeah, I think if I tried to summarise what I thought, I was thinking about the families who are crossing the English Channel to claim asylum, and about the sort of the Westminster government and the mainstream media pointing at them and being like, oh, don't look at what's happening over here, look over there, those are the bad people coming across the water. And I do wonder, I think where I got to was, I would rather have a government in the age where that kind of thing is happening cack-handedly try to legislate for kindness and goodness rather than joining in with the baying mob that I see in other places, I guess. But that's probably quite a hopeful interpretation.
Happy to end on a hopeful note. Absolutely. Why not? Might catch on. Well, faithful listener, that's about all for us this month. I know you'll miss us, but please, don't worry too much. I know that at first you might be afraid, you might be petrified, and thinking you could never live without us by your side. But it won't be oh so many days and oh so many nights before we'll be back. Just a month, in fact, though we probably won't be back from outer space, because I never did understand that bit. Meantime, why not follow us on Twitter at @small_voice1, subscribe to the show on iTunes, or visit our Facebook page. So until next month, trust me, you will survive.